Anyway, let's move on. Now, I want to talk to you about a story that appeared on the news and on RTE.ie. It was about hundreds of natterjack toads which have been released in County Kerry in what is a first for Ireland's newest national park, Park na Siúnta na Mara. 1,000 natterjacks have been bred in Dingle Ocean World Aquarium in a volunteer breeding programme in conjunction with the National Parks and Wildlife Service. 500 toadlets, they're called, were released into the dunes at Inch Peninsula in Dingle in County Kerry, which are now state-owned as part of Park na Siúnta na Mara. Now, we have been following the story of natterjack toads for a very long time here on RTE Radio. In fact, one of the very first programmes I worked on with my late colleague, the great Dick Warner, was a documentary about natterjack toads on the Maharees Peninsula.
He's a bit smaller than a full-grown frog, just a tiny bit, I suppose, and with this brown, warty skin and a very pronounced yellowish-green stripe all the way down the back. And underneath is this lovely sort of speckledy grey and white colour. Oh, with these fantastic hands. And he doesn't move at all like a frog. Just put him down for a second and let's see what he does. Oh, yeah.
A bit more gainly looking.
Yeah, I think they're great.
Yeah.
A wonderful sound of natterjack toads. And before that, you heard Dick Warner, who is the original producer of Mooney Goes Wild. We're going to say hello now to Kevin Flannery, who's the founder of Dingle Ocean World Aquarium. And you might be wondering what they have to do with natterjack toads. Well, he'll tell us all about it. Hello, Kevin.
Hello, Derek. Hi, folks. How are you all doing? Basically, Derek, what it was is MPWS, Dr. Ferdy Marnell, contacted us, and we've been doing this for a number of years, is that basically some of the ponds that would be in the Inch, Castlemaine area, in Maharees, they dry out. Not this year, but every other year, they dry out. But also the survival rate of the tadpoles and the tadpole eggs in the ponds in these specific areas where the toads are. And they ask us, could we help out? And what we do is the MPWS, Wildlife Rangers, they transfer the tadpoles back to us and we hold them in what we have, a hatchery as such. And we help them, we grow them on until they're ready for release. And then MPWS come and they take them and release them back in after a few months. But in the meantime, it involves a lot of work, a lot of care and a lot of maintenance. Because, as I said, the survival rate in the wild for the natterjacks is out of each one of the rows of eggs that they lay is very, very small. 1 or 2%, maybe 3% out of every couple of thousand.
Now, can you describe a natterjack toad for us? It's different to the common frog that we have in Ireland, and it's Ireland's only toad. How did it get here? How is it doing? Why do we have to make such efforts to make sure it survives?
It is vital because it's the only toad, as you say, we have, and it's totally different from your frog, and it's got this yellow line down its back. And as the great late Dick Warner was saying there, down when he was down in Maharees doing the programme with you, you can see the difference. But they were virtually under threat because, of course, intensive farming that came with the advent of the EU and everything else. So it's vital that we preserve them. And especially now, we have to be very grateful to the government because they now have bought Inch Island and they've created the park tomorrow where hopefully now there'll be no more interference from land animals or domestic animals or anything else and they will survive. How they came here is an interesting one I'd love to throw to Aina and your, because some people believe that they came, and my own thing would be there were probably Spanish vessels that were coming up here and trading, as we know, there's huge trade in the southwest with Spain and still is, and they were possibly being used as a food source. I don't know, or maybe they came as ballast and came ashore here in the Dingle Peninsula. And then they spread like that. But that's only my own assumption on how they came here. But I'd be interested to see what Richard or Ian would have to say on that. But as I say, it's so important that we preserve them and keep them here. And hopefully they'll expand out into the Inch Island area that has been bought by NPWS.
Yeah, do you good, Kevin? Going to start to feel Todd, I'm sure Jasok of Hiss and Shinnick and Bomberton, I will.
So I should go even.
This is great work about the toad, and I see you're putting it to me, where do they come from? And I started off in the Biological Record Centre way back in the 70s, and there was a fellow who discovered them in the first, or he was very funny, he was an English a zoologist, and he wrote a paper about them, and he had discovered them. And should the people at Kerry said, "Sure, we knew they were there all the time." I mean, he was the first person who wrote about it in a scientific paper. But the people of Kerry have obviously always knew that they were there. But the biogeography people are saying lately that in fact they were here. They were part of our native fauna, that they didn't come in ballast or they didn't come from Spain. They were actually part of a population or an area on the very west of the world or of Europe after the end of the last ice age on land bridges. We have them just in Cornwall. We have them in Ireland. We have them in France and Spain. But just at the very tips of the peninsulas, that it wasn't that they were brought. That's all that's left of a population that was bigger than that. And more DNA analysis presumably will be able to show how long our ones are isolated from other ones in Spain and places like that. If they came up as ballast, I mean, the idea of ballast is not that there were so many toads that they kept the ship down, but that the sand that they would put into the holds to keep them steady was taken from the dunes beside where they were sailing from the beaches, and there might be toads and things shoveled in for good measure while they were at it. So the jury is still very much out, as far as I know, Kevin, on where they actually came from. But they certainly have made themselves at home there, and the habitat changes have been a huge problem. I remember Castlemaine Golf Course, when I was there in the 70s, had down beside their last fairway, they had natterjack toads, and then a seawall broke and the salt water came in. And salt water, they need freshwater ponds, not salt water, even though they're beside the sea. And to their everlasting credit, the golf course, I mean, and this was now in the 70s when, you know, wildlife were the enemy of golf courses because they kept golf courses from being developed and things. The Castlemaine Golf Course rebuilt their wall and they re-established those toads back there then. I wonder, are they still there in that, or did they succumb over the years? You don't know anything about that now, do you, Kevin?
They're still there. To the best of my knowledge, MPWS are keeping an eye on them all the time, and hopefully they're expanding. But as you say, back in the 70s, wildlife was the enemy of people in that sense, that they didn't want them there and they had a fear that they might interfere with whatever else they were doing, be domesticating animals or playing golf or something else. And I know the same situation was down in the Maharees in the golf club area, and now they're a welcome visit to it and people are delighted to see them there. And in actual fact, they've expanded their range down there in the Maharees in the golf club, and hopefully over in Dukes as well, over in the Cremon, that area over there. And with the help that we're giving them, and with the help through Parks and Wildlife, though, we've put out, I'd say, over 2,500 of them this year, alive, well, and how would you say, hopping. So, and we were delighted to do that. We've been doing it since 2017. So I'm hopeful for their future. I am seriously hopeful for their future if we can keep doing this. Obviously, Fota Island, they help out as well. They do a series of them. So between MPWS and ourselves and Fota, I think their future could be bright, and maybe they might extend, the population might spread outwards a bit more.
We must be doing something right after all in our 30 years of programming. But the thing you were saying about alive and hopping, the difference between frogs and toads, of course, is that frogs hop and toads don't. Toads walk, and the common toad that you see on the continent is actually, might look like a frog to begin with, but it walks away, it doesn't hop. But of course, the natterjack toads, being Kerry toads, they don't walk, they run. They actually run like little mice rather than actually walking like the big cumbersome toads that you get on the continent, which makes them even more endearing, I suppose, that they run around like this and they're brown with their yellow stripe down their back. So you couldn't possibly mistake them for a frog by any manner of means.
I know that when it comes to amphibians, but we in Ireland, we've been often seen as the poor relation in European context because we have so few species. We have three native species, including the natterjack toad. One of the concerns I know that's been rearing its head in recent years is the risk from non-native species being introduced or inadvertently or even deliberately released in Ireland. We've seen a species called the alpine newt appearing in the Midlands now, presumably being tipped out of aquariums and so on. Do you know, Kevin, is that something that's been watched for, that the problems that an invasive species could bring in? And I know particularly with amphibians, it's because of a fungal infection that can then spread and could, you know, potentially wipe out a population that's so fragile, like these natterjack toads in Kerry.
It is, Niall. And you know, the most worrying part about it is the free access and the access in of all these species that can be got so easily. I mean, in car boot sales virtually anywhere up around the north or through the UK, and they're being brought in. And very easily, I have reason to believe there was some sort of a toad released into a lake up in Cavan, and that has expanded out. And it's a very worrying aspect now. And the big thing, I think, Parks and Wildlife have to get out there is to reinforce it to the public that, you know, you just can't buy these as domestic pets and you can't keep them in the house, because obviously the situation we have found, an interesting one, even with type of turtle that people believe they're buying, but they're not buying them, and they're releasing them back into the wild. We've had to collect hundreds of them. We had to give up actually collecting them when people were buying them, and Johnny was going off to college, and then Mammy and Daddy possibly dumped it somewhere, and people believe that, look, we're after finding a turtle, we're after finding a loggerhead, we're after finding this, and we find that they're just the ordinary common red sliders, and we've had to pick it up. And it's so easy to bring them into the country, and they're for sale, and there needs to be more restriction put in place, because, as you say, it will endanger through the various diseases and viruses that they can bring in.
I am actually often shocked about what is available for sale freely. You need a license to keep a dog in Ireland, but you don't need a license to keep all sorts of other much more exotic pets that are freely traded. I think, you know, given that we live on an island, we have a major advantage from other countries in that we can control this more easily. But it seems that these controls just don't happen. It's too easy for people to bring things in either legally or illegally. And then when you see a species that's so restricted like the natterjack toad, the great efforts that are going to save it, it would be tragic if just one person inadvertently caused the demise of that whole species. So I do think biosecurity is something we need to be a lot more mindful of in Ireland. And we're seeing, you know, invasive, as Aina was saying earlier, about this moth now that affects box hedges and so on. These things come in all the time, and we really should be doing a lot more to try and combat that.
Richard.
Kevin, could I ask you, it used to be said that the natterjack toad in Kerry came from Britain. The nearest genetic match to our ones in Kerry, I think, comes from Lancashire. Now, it doesn't necessarily imply that our ones came from Lancashire. Maybe the Lancashire ones came from ours. But I'd like to ask you about the rearing of them in captivity. You had them in captivity. Now, from the days long ago when we used to keep frogs for the kids and the tadpoles would develop, the tadpoles used to eat each other at a certain stage. You know, you'd find that the number of tadpoles in the tank dropped with time. And what was happening, of course, there were cannibal tadpoles. Now, is that the case with natterjacks? Are you keeping them all together, and do they get on, or do they eat each other? Or what is the dynamic of raising natterjacks in captivity?
It's an interesting one, and you're actually right, Richard, and they are possibly cannibalistic, and they will eat the tail of the thing, but they use it up. But what we do is we saturate them with food. We have given them the lettuce, but we give them blue-green algae, spirulina, which we and we feed them on that, and they thrive. And once they have plenty of that type of food to thrive on, they tend to stay away from one another. We do get a variation of sizes, because when we get them in, we'll say at the very early end of April, start of May, they are in a stress state, because obviously something might have dried out or they might be in that. But we have specialised tanks, and then we saturate them with food. They thrive on lettuce, they thrive on the spirulina, this blue-green algae. And now I see this blue-green algae has been in sale in shops for people to take as a drink, and I've seen some astronauts are being given it because it has all the basic vitamins, the amino acids, everything else. But once they get enough of this, once you provide them with enough of food, they tend to stay away. So the returns we're getting, you know, the mortality rate is very, very small, provided you keep doing this. You'd be looking at 3-4% mortality rate, which has worked out very well for us. Now, it was obviously trial and error initially at the start, but the advent and the availability of the spirulina and just the right water temperatures, we have found that we are able to get a greater return of these onto the wild. We then transfer them once they lose the tail as such, once they use that up, the energy from their tail, and once they have grown their legs, we then move them on to another different part of the hatchery, where they are fed on fruit flies, a type of fruit fly that we breed, and it's confined inside in these cases as such with them. And they thrive on these fruit flies, and it gets them used to the natural wild environment where they will have to capture their own insects. And we grow these on then to the next stage. And then once they're finished that stage, we transfer them back out into the wild. Well, it's MPWS, the wildlife officers, because we'd like to keep it confined, and they know exactly where to put them out and keep them away from the general public and the general beach area where people would be. But they go through these three different stages with us, Richard. And as I say, once we have found the proper type of food and algae that they thrive on, we are finding that the cannibalistic effort of them is reduced greatly once they have that type of food.
Well, how long does all that process take? I mean, it takes them a long time to breed. There's 2 or 3 years they stay on land, and then they go into the ponds and that kind of thing. Now, did you have these things for years, months, or what?
No. In actual fact, we get them in around the end of April, pending on the condition of the ponds and, as I say, the weather and everything impending. The wildlife rangers keep a very close eye on it, and they see how the ponds are doing and how the eggs are developing and if there's any danger to it. But even if there isn't, because what we have developed is this methodology. So let's say we get them in the end of April, the first weekend of May, and by mid-July to the end of July, we are able to release them back out into the wild. Now, they're at a very small stage, but you have to do that. Ongrowing them, which has been done by FOTA, is a different kettle of fish as such. You could keep them on, but our preference, and working with the MPWS, Dr. Ferdy Emanuel, is grow enough of them and release them back into the wild at that stage when they're capable of fending for themselves.
And you have virgin ponds into which you can put them, in which there is no knackerjack present already. So you're able to measure how well it does. If you put them in with the others, the natives, presumably they lose out in competition, or maybe they don't. But you can tell what factors are leading to their success. But if you put them into virgin ponds, ponds in which there are no knackerjacks already, of course, you don't know how suitable those ponds are, but you have a good idea. It's a very interesting one from the point of view of the zoology of it to test that. Do they do as well or better than the ones raised in the wild?
It would be a very interesting question, but basically what we're trying to do at this point in time, because it was an emergency situation that brought it about when the ponds were drying out and the farmers had no, couldn't do nothing about it, basically. So they were all going, a year's load of tadpoles were going to die off. So basically when the situation arose, we jumped at the to help out MPWS and bring them in. And it's since that, and as you initially said about them devouring one another, if we hadn't learned this, the numbers we would be able to return to the wild would have been extremely low. But now that we're able to do this, I think further investigation could go on. We're doing this on a voluntary basis, you must understand, whereas I think it could be done maybe by some of the universities or something like that. Should look into it, Richard, what you're looking for. But our main point, and I think the point of the MPWS, is just to get and maintain the good breeding stock and to maintain these species here.
Well, if John O'Halloran in UCC is listening in, I'm sure he'll get one of his students to do the work. Anyway, go ahead, Niall.
Yeah, we've been talking, Kevin, about how the adult toads differ from frogs in their behaviour and their appearance. But one of the things I think is most distinctive and most interesting about the natterjack toad is how different its eggs are. I'm sure many people listening to us will be very familiar with frog spawns, big massive of gelatinous eggs that you'll see in ponds and around the country at certain times of the year. But when it comes to natterjack toads, their eggs are very different, aren't they?
They are, and they lay them along the bottom. But it's the big problem. Well, people will, let's hope that an awful lot of people wouldn't see them. I know the people in Maharees and all that know exactly, and they know the mating, because they would tell me, and some people say, oh my God, can we ever get to sleep because of the noise they create down there when they're mating, as Dick Warner's programme had shown there. But the egg masses are totally different than your ordinary frog spawn. But as I say, nobody should interfere with them, and MPAWS thankfully now are keeping a greater watch on them to see where they are and the numbers that are there.
Yeah, absolutely, and people of course absolutely should not go anywhere near where these animals are suspected to be reproducing, and shouldn't interfere in any way. But the eggs themselves, they lay them in long strings or chains, don't they? They get wrapped around vegetation underneath the water rather than bobbing around near the surface in a big mass the way the frog's eggs would.
Yeah, you can see them under the water, and they're, as you say, they're in a long chain in the bottom. But my preference is for nobody to go see them or looking at them, and that only the people who own the land or are adjacent to it should be at them, because some people have been collecting these and they think it's okay to collect stuff and take it in, like it was done years ago, as Ian would say, bring them into the classroom, and every house virtually brought in frog spawn and they started hatching them out and doing this. But it's all getting so scarce in the wild that all that stuff should be left into the wild and leave it there.
Mind you, the frogs, I mean, the frogs are more abundant, the actual frogs, as opposed to the toads. I don't think anybody ever brought in natterjack toad eggs into school, but you can still actually bring frog spawn into school because the NPWS give a derogation every year from the EU directive. So, you know, that sometimes can happen in places where there's lots of frog spawn. So not to get those two things mixed up. Frogs are different to toads. These toads are particularly rare. They're only down in Kerry. I wanted to ask you though, Kevin, there was a part of the acre scheme or the GLOS scheme where the farmers were excavating ponds along the other side of the Dingle Peninsula, the south side of it, and if toads took up residence, they got extra payments. Did that work well, do you think, down that end? Yeah,
it did. It worked very well initially, but then again, like everything else, it's hard to believe that ponds do dry out. The wet summer that we're having even this year, but the ponds tend to dry out sometimes, and especially when you had intensive farming and the whole lot. And they were getting paid to do this. And this is where the MPWS people, the wildlife rangers, have been. And they keep a very close eye on these ponds. And then if they find that the ponds are drying out and the eggs are in danger of drying out and the whole lot, that's when they move them to both ourselves and to Forta straight away. And it was through these ponds that was initially drying out that we got the initial first batch. But now the situation had arose that there wasn't enough in reproduction, and I'd say we'll virtually have this every year going forward, that to help out and to increase the numbers in the wild, because they are under threat, and there was intensive farming took place in all them areas, and as I said, the ponds did dry out. So that's how initially we started out, and that's how MPWS came to us and we took them in then.
Just for the benefit of the listeners, NPWS, which we keep referring to, is the National Parks and Wildlife Service. Kevin, it's a terrific effort and well done to everybody concerned. Just before we leave you, how is Dingle Ocean World Aquarium doing? What are your numbers like? Are people still flocking?
People are still coming, Derek. What we do is we come up with something different. And you, as you know, fishermen, and especially with the iPhone and everything, they're still coming up with something different. And I thought this year with the colder temperatures, the colder sea temperature, because I honestly think they're well down on last year from our intake. The temperatures are 4 or 5 degrees different than last year, but we still get different species. I got a species of comber, would you believe, a fisherman up on Donegal Bay, John Mayer of the Charlie Bay, and Eddie Moore here. They picked up which they thought was a cuckoo wrasse. This species is very like a cuckoo wrasse, but in actual fact it's a comber. And they have only been found up north of the English Channel. We very, very, very rarely get this type of fish coming into our waters. As well as that, we picked up deep water crayfish, white crayfish, which are Mauritanica, so they're basically African crayfish. And one of these was picked up northwest of the Blaskets. So there's still interesting stuff, but as I say, most of the stuff is coming from the southern region all the time, which obviously means that we have warming waters, and we are picking up and showing people and put them on display and trying to educate people on about the seas all the time.
Yeah, the comber is actually a Portuguese fish. They eat it, actually. It's one of the fish they eat. As you said, it's a bony thing, one of the perch family. But yeah, to be finding it up as far as the English Channel, but now to be getting it up in Donegal Bay, it really indicates the warming of the waters. And cod are a cold water fish. Are we in danger of the cod shoving on further north and losing our cod?
I would safely say they're gone, because what we have found when we had them in the aquarium, when we had them on display, once it goes over 16 degrees, the cod is gone. So Look, there was a big cod fishery down off of Dunmore East. One time there was a big cod fishery, and I would safely say they have moved further north. Even it's proving, even the Markle, the Spanish research people have shown that there's a 45-kilometre movement every year virtually with Markle that go into their waters after spawning and down spawning off of there, and they're moving further north. There is, without a doubt, your usual cod. I mean, if you go into any restaurant in Ireland, you'll now see the Ryanair fish, as I call a hake. Every person that has been down in Spain said, oh, we got fabulous fish down there, and now in Ireland virtually in every restaurant you'll get nothing else but hake for sale in there, because plenty of hake been landed into Ireland and it's been sold in every restaurant, and you won't see cod virtually on the menu at all.
Why did you call it the Ryanair fish? I hope that wasn't an insult. Don't want Michael O'Leary suing us in the courts or anything like that.
No, everybody's been down to Spain and they say, oh, we had fabulous fish, we had fabulous fish. What they're eating down there is the fish that's cut off of the Irish coast, the hake, and it's brought down to Spain and sold there. And now all of a sudden they come back and everybody is putting it on the menu, and every restaurant in Ireland virtually has hake on the menu.
Okay. So. Listen, since Fungi disappeared, no sign of him for a good few years now, has tourism been hit in the area, or does it matter? Are you still doing okay?
We're doing okay. We're doing very well because we put on something different every year. We put on different species and different things. But the eco, what the fishermen and everybody is realising, they're seeing more whales. They have eco tours left, right and centre. In actual fact, the numbers going to sea in sea safaris and in visitor numbers has actually increased even since Fungi that, because the fishermen realised and the boat tours realised, look, take them out and show them the minkies, the humpbacks, the dolphins, the porpoises, all the seals, everything around the Blasket Islands. And people are getting greater value for money. Rather than looking for one dolphin, they're able to see all these different species. So hopefully...
Yeah, but come on, you must all miss Fungi.
Of course, Derek. I mean, he was part and parcel nearly of the family. Everybody go out to the mouth of the harbour, you'd see him every day and he was there. But it's sad, but everything moves on, and people now are looking forward to seeing the return of the humpback whales and the minke whales and all the different species.
Well, good luck to you, Kevin. Thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.
Talk to you again. Bye.
Bye.
There goes Kevin Flannery. And don't forget, if you find yourself in the Dingle area, you can go out on a sea safari or you can keep your feet dry and go in and visit the Dingle Ocean World Aquarium.